It's Monday, February 25th. If there's a special part of hell for those who do nothing, what happens to soldiers who shoot starving people? We start here. Venezuela crosses a new line.
The amount of people that I saw injured was unbelievable.
How things spiraled out of control amid a power struggle, and what this weekend's military defections could mean for the U.S. President Trump gets ready for a wild ride.
We will kind of get an idea of where the Mueller report is going.
Why Kim Jong-un could be his third biggest challenge this week. And critics called him a criminal. Now authorities in Chicago agree.
Four alleged victims, three of whom were between the ages of 13 and 17.
How R. Kelly wound up in a cell and what kept him there over the weekend. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. When world leaders started coming forward and saying, hey, people of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro is not the president anymore. Juan Guaido should be your president, and we support him. That has got civil war written all over it. In other countries, we've seen that story before. And yet, so far, we have not seen a civil war in Venezuela. We've seen protests, we've seen dueling statements, but we had not seen widespread violence until this weekend.
Deadly clashes have erupted in border towns across Venezuela as opposition activists try to break government blockades to bring in foreign aid.
We had told you this was a possibility. Other countries, including the U.S., have been sending trucks full of food and medicine right up to the Venezuelan border. It's just sitting there. But Maduro has said, we don't need it, we don't want it, our people are not allowed to go get it. Guaido said, no, we're going to get this aid, we have volunteers who are going across the border. They're going to get those boxes, those trucks. They're going to come back with them. If you want to shoot someone carrying rice and medicine, be my guest. And suddenly, with Vice President Mike Pence on his way to Colombia today, we might be closer to an outright civil war in Venezuela than we were a few days ago. ABC's Davi Merchand was on the border when everything went down. So, Davi, where are you right now?
Yeah, so I am actually still in Cúcuta, Colombia, and this is the town where four bridges connect to Venezuela. But over the weekend, this town became, you know, a big center, pretty much a battleground, really, between Venezuela's military and just protesters and volunteers that were desperate to get the aid across. This whole thing actually really began on Friday. Friday was the day that British millionaire Richard Branson put together this concert that was aimed to raise funds and, you know, resources for Venezuela.
Let's come together and bring change now.
But in a way, it could be that this show was actually a distraction because Juan Guaido, Venezuela's interim president, actually showed up at the concert so he could leave Venezuela and come to Cúcuta to kind of spearhead, you know, this humanitarian aid effort.
But he just showed up? Like Guaido just walked across the border?
He did, yes. It's still kind of unknown exactly how he did so, but the thing that he made sure people knew was the military, Venezuela's military, was actually involved in the process. And I think in a way that kind of created this hope or this, we were waiting for some signs, some indication of what was happening inside Venezuela's military. Would they support Guaido? Would they support Maduro? But as of Friday morning, we still didn't know.
So then what happened?
And so Saturday morning rolls around. And, you know, there are people out and about, especially at the Simón Bolívar Bridge. They're just waiting for instructions. And then confusion kind of breaks out because there are three armored vehicles from the Venezuelan side that are just rushing into the Colombian side of the border. It just creates a lot of confusion, and people are starting to wonder, you know, is this Venezuela's military attacking its own people? And then all of a sudden, as the day progresses, we kind of get some clarity. These were actually three military people turning their back on Maduro. They ran into the Colombian side, asked Colombia for help, and, you know, that was just the first three defections that we saw on Saturday. And at some point, we start hearing reports of violence. And one of the places where violence broke out was the Ureña Bridge. It's a bridge not far from where the aid was being stored. And I was at the bridge for maybe an hour, 2 hours later in the day. And the amount of people that I saw injured was unbelievable. Military is firing pellets onto the crowd. They're throwing tear gas, or shotguns that were heard. It is believed that these shotguns were actually coming from the Colectivos, which is an armed group in Venezuela that is supported by Maduro. You know, many people on Saturday morning were saying, you know, they would do whatever it takes. Two of the trucks with humanitarian aid caught on fire. It is believed that, you know, at some point tear gas was thrown and it hit the trucks and, you know, they lit on fire. It's not really sure what happened, but they were desperate for this aid. They thought this was the moment. And all of a sudden, under Maduro's order, not just did it not make it through, but now it was gone. And so, Brad, you know, I am just in one place right now. I am in Cúcuta, but Venezuela borders with other places as well. You know, in Brazil on Friday, many were injured. And inside Venezuela on Saturday, a lot of clashes and protests also went on. The international community is also responding to this because there is this perception that now Maduro has really shown who he is. He has shown that he is depriving his people of things that they really, really need. And in a way, it's not just denying the help, it's even burning it.
Fuera tus manos de Venezuela, Yankee, go home!
Well, the Trump administration has pointedly said military options are still on the table. Davi, what about the defections with Maduro's military? Like when soldiers saw starving countrymen being shot, did that make more of them start jumping over?
By the end of Saturday, we had actually heard of 60 military defections. It seems, however, that Maduro is really still holding on to power. And so for a revolution to actually be successful, you know, for things to really change in Venezuela, it needs to be more than 60 defections. And one thing that Guaido pointed out himself is defections are not really getting them anywhere because they need people inside Venezuela. They need the military forces inside Venezuela to stay there and fight, not fight against the Venezuelan people, but fight along Guaido and the opposition and dethrone Maduro. And so far, that just hasn't happened.
Yeah, the dream scenario for Guaido is all the generals just change sides and give Guaido power without a shot fired. But that has not happened so far, and now Guaido is not even in Venezuela. Davi Merchand, racing from bridge to bridge all weekend to give us this news. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
So as Vice President Pence heads to Colombia to meet face-to-face with his new ally, Juan Guaido, President Trump is leaving the country today as well as he gets ready to meet the dictator he has called a maniac, Kim Jong-un. And so you'd think foreign policy would be the only thing on anyone's mind in Washington, but instead, Trump leaves behind a city scurrying to prepare for the most anticipated testimony of the year and perhaps the most anticipated report in a generation. ABC's Tara Palmieri is at the White House, and Tara, it appears that if Robert Mueller's findings are coming out, they're not coming out this week. So where does this investigation stand?
It's wrapping up and they will likely come out in the next few weeks. But you have to remember that while Michael Cohen is testifying publicly on Capitol Hill for the first time on Wednesday, he can only be asked about things outside of the Mueller report.
Or he can't answer the Mueller stuff, at least.
So in a way, we will kind of get an idea of where the Mueller report is going because he can't be asked about something that's in that report and that Mueller is investigating.
Oh, so if Cohen talks about something, that basically means you're not going to find this in the Mueller report then.
Exactly.
And there have been lots of people who have questioned whether report is really the word at all, right? Like, we might not get an actual definitive chronicling of what happened during the campaign, right? So what would that even look like? Do we know?
An actual report will be handed over to the Department of Justice, and then it's up to the Attorney General what to do with it. How much of it will he make public? Will he make the entire thing public? Will he hand it over to Congress? Will they subpoena it?
What if they simply say, no, we're not going to release the underlying evidence? What options do you have?
Well, we will obviously subpoena the report. We will bring Bob Mueller in to testify before Congress. We will take it to court if necessary.
That is the unknown. The unknown is how much we will see.
Which is why House Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff was telling ABC's This Week, Attorney General William Barr better not squash this or he's coming after him. As for North Korea, Tara, walk me through this summit. How does the White House feel about it this week?
They are cautiously optimistic, I think you could say. They want to see an accounting of their nuclear arsenal. And they also want to see concrete steps to denuclearization.
There's no nuclear testing, no missiles going up, and we have a good relationship, very good relationship.
President Trump, on the other hand, sees the fact that there hasn't been a missile launch as a sign of success. And where he may want to make a splash and make a big announcement, maybe the declaration to officially end the Korean War after the armistice in 1953, that could be one of those things. The Koreans want to hear that there'll be sanctions relief. But how much of this is going to be symbolic again after a first summit that was largely symbolic? And the question is, how much is North Korea willing to give up and how much is the U.S. willing to give up?
Does that mean we see more daylight between, say, the president and his secretary of state? Because they contradicted each other before and they're contradicting each other now, right?
That's right. Yesterday morning, Mike Pompeo said that North Korea is still a nuclear threat. And I'm sure you remember that tweet from President Trump where he flat out said North Korea is no longer a nuclear threat after his summit in Singapore.
What he said was that the efforts that had been made in Singapore, this commitment that Chairman Kim made, have substantially taken down the risk to the American people.
He said that they haven't done enough to dismantle their nuclear arsenal. So as you can see, there is a bit of a divide.
I'm in no rush. There's no testing. As long as there's no testing, I'm in no rush.
President Trump, even in his rhetoric, seems to acknowledge that they aren't making the progress that he anticipated they would after he had his hug and his handshake with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore. Let's see what their body language is like this time. President Trump has said, though, that he thinks he can do what no other U.S. president has done before because of his personal relationship with Kim.
On another relationship-warming news, amid all this, the president's been negotiating with China on tariffs. Now he says enough progress has been made where he can extend this trade deal past this weekend without imposing new tariffs on China. Exactly what a lot of Wall Street people were hoping to hear this morning. Tara at the White House, thank you.
Thanks.
Next up on Start Here, last time he was in a Chicago courtroom, R. Kelly was acquitted. Now prosecutors say times have changed.
Can you describe the physical abuse?
Just a few days after the new year, Lifetime premiered a new documentary called Surviving R. Kelly.
Why didn't anyone notice? We all noticed. No one cared because we were black girls.
I'm sorry.
And in interview after interview, acquaintances and alleged victims painted a disturbing portrait of a famed musician, beloved in many respects, surrounding himself with young, even underage women, with some of them saying they became victims of abuse. And R. Kelly has been charged with sex-related crimes before.
14 counts of child pornography stemming from that infamous sex tape in which prosecutors say he stars.
But all those charges have either been dropped or they resulted in not guilty verdicts. So for parents alleging he's mistreated their daughters, there's a big difference between public outrage and jail time. Well, on Friday, authorities in Chicago charged Kelly with sexual abuse, and despite his celebrity, Kelly could not avoid spending the weekend in jail. ABC's Lindsay Davis has been tracking the fallout ever since these stories went public. And Lindsay, important here probably to draw a line between anecdotes and actual criminal allegations. So what are the charges here from prosecutors?
Yes, Brad. So we're talking about 10 counts of aggravated criminal sexual assault involving four alleged victims, three of whom were between the ages of 13 and 17 when the alleged incidents occurred. We're talking about going back as far as 1998 to as recently as 2010. And in court on Saturday, you had the Cook County prosecutor, Kim Fox, who described R. Kelly's interactions with each alleged victim in graphic detail.
The victim met Robert Kelly on her 16th birthday, where she was celebrating at a restaurant.
At one point, the judge even said, look, these allegations are disturbing. He did go on, though, to set a bond for Kelly at $1 million.
These allegations are also not necessarily about recent events. So, I mean, what changed for prosecutors? Was the documentary a big part of it?
You know, the documentary really reignited this need, it seemed, at least by the court of public opinion, that, look, R. Kelly needs to be investigated and perhaps put in jail.
Do I believe that he should serve time in jail? I do.
You would like to see him arrested?
Yes.
And so what's very interesting is what was revealed in court on Saturday is that one of the four alleged victims is the same young woman who was at the center of the child pornography case against him in 2008.
The tape at issue does not involve the same acts at issue in the 2008 trial.
Now, what Michael Avenatti has said, the attorney who's representing these four alleged victims, he's saying, look, this is not a case of double jeopardy, as R. Kelly's lawyer had tried to argue. But in addition to that, now you don't just have the one young lady. You have three other women who are now also being represented in this case, that the grand jury passed down the indictment on him. And that's in addition to, you know, the chorus of women that we heard in the Surviving R. Kelly documentary coming forward saying, look, this happened to me too.
Well, so what does happen next? Because usually you think someone gets charged with a crime, especially a celebrity, they bond out, they wait for the trial. R. Kelly basically could not afford to do that.
What's so interesting, going into court, the bond hearing on Saturday, it wasn't clear whether or not R. Kelly was going to even be offered bond. You know, it was thought that maybe they would say, look, you've got to stay behind bars. You're a threat to, you know, young women in society, perhaps. But no, the judge actually said, look, $1 million bond set. So, of course, he just had to come up with $100,000. And for somebody like R. Kelly, who at one time has sold more than, you know, 60 million records, and Billboard had called him the most prolific R&B artist in the last 25 years, just a few years ago. But as his own attorney said in court, he said, look, his finances are a mess.
He's trying to get it together. He doesn't have it sitting in the bank, sitting in a shoebox. Anyway, no.
He doesn't currently have any income coming in as far as tours or royalties. We've learned since that, according to court documents, he's now back in excess of $160,000 in child payments that he owes and child support payments. He was going to be remanded to jail on March 6th if he did not come up with the $161,000 of back child support payments. So he now has this going.
Oh, like he could be going to jail for that regardless of even what goes down here.
He could be going to jail regardless.
And Kelly's attorney says there is nothing credible in any of these allegations. But like you said, 10 charges, 4 accusers. We'll see how this plays out. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thanks, Brad.
The symbolism was incredible. The leader of the Catholic Church calling bishops from around the world to talk about the scourge of sexual abuse by priests through the decades. Nothing like this had been done before, even though, of course, it's been 17 years since the Boston Globe put the spotlight on it.
Some organizations move slowly, but this is ridiculous.
Some of those survivors even attended this summit in Rome. So, like I said, the symbolism was all there, but what actually came of it? ABC's David Wright was in Rome as this all went down. He's still there now. And David, after all this build up, what were the takeaways of this weekend?
Well, the Pope had some very strong words at the end of this 4-day summit.
Secondo i dati ufficiali del governo americano,
he talked about declaring all-out war on abuse. He talked about the righteous anger of survivors of sexual abuse. Saying that to the church, it's pretty much like the wrath of God. But he was short on specifics in terms of what concrete measures the church will take going forward. And that left many survivors disappointed.
Yeah, I was going to say, are there actionable steps that the church could be taking that it's not? I guess, are there survivors saying, hey, here's a bullet list of things you should do, and we're just not seeing it?
Here are the bullet points. They want to see a one-strike policy for predator priests. They want to see a one-strike policy for bishops who covered up. And they want to see complete transparency from the church in terms of opening up the records, the secret archives of all of the priests and bishops who've been found guilty in this scandal.
Making it clear that the destruction of documents relating to abuse is a grave, grave mistake and a crime, probably.
Church officials tell us they are working on that.
At a minimum, the new standards that you will adopt will include those three things.
Yes, they're essential.
But survivors say, you know, as you pointed out at the beginning, you know, this has been going on for a while now. Why is it taking so long?
All right, that is David Wright in Rome. Great work over the last several days, David. We'll see you back in the States.
Thanks, Brad.
We made this film with love. And we made it with tenderness.
And one last thing. On a night in which Green Book, a story about race, won Best Picture, in which it was introduced by Congressman John Lewis, who overcame struggle after struggle himself, one of the big questions at the Oscars was, after 91 years, would Spike Lee finally become the first African-American to win an Academy Award for directing?
And the Oscar goes to
this name I can't pronounce, Alfonso Cuarón.
Spike Lee didn't win, although he did jump on Samuel Jackson to receive his first Oscar for screenwriting.
Make the moral choice between love versus hate. Let's do the right thing. You know I had to get that in there.
And you know, the focus is always on categories like acting, directing, music. But the film industry, every industry, relies on the people who do the work you don't hear about.
Marvel may have created the first black superhero, but through costume design, we turned him into an African king.
You might have missed this, but early in the evening, in the span of literally a few minutes, Ruth Carter became the first black costume designer to win an Oscar, and Hannah Beechler became the first African-American to win for production design. A bit later, Peter Ramsey became the first black director to win for animated feature. He directed a Spider-Man who, by the way, speaks Spanish, which Ramsey did not give subtitles to. And there are lots of kids out there who don't love being on stage. They don't want to. They just want to work somewhere in show business. And this morning, a child who wants to design costumes or sets, or who just wants to be Spider-Man, when they woke up today, their future was just a little bit clearer. All right, you're off and running. And we put out the call for ratings and reviews. You guys delivered, dude. Keep them coming. It legit makes a difference in how people find us. If you're looking for more info about the dynamics of the Mueller probe right now, whenever it finishes up, remember, check out ABC's new podcast, The Investigation. And you can get more on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.